Welcome back to the podcast, Unbinding the Bible. I've titled this week's episode, By the Book, The Me Too Reckoning. And I am very excited to share with you a conversation that I had with Ruth Everhart on her book, The Me Too Reckoning, Facing the Church's Complicity in Sexual Abuse and Misconduct. And one of the main reasons I'm so excited to share this conversation with you is because Ruth and I engage in a very pastoral and a very caring discussion regarding what Scripture has to say about abuse, what Scripture has to say about the abuse of power, and how the church can honestly begin to assess what sadly has been turned into oftentimes a partisan discussion regarding the hashtag MeToo. And it is no surprise to anyone that in churches today even, we are seeing story after story after story surface of the abuse of power and how that has worked its way into various avenues, not least of which is in the sexual abuse arena. And so I'm really thankful for Ruth. This, I believe, is a conversation that every church needs to have. This is certainly a conversation that's not an easy topic to discuss, but one that is vital, especially in our day and age, as there are no doubt countless thousands, potentially millions of people, some of whom are sitting in our pews, carrying tremendous weight and guilt and shame for the things that have happened to them. And it's a very real reality that sometimes even in our churches, people do not feel safe enough. They do not trust leadership enough or trust the people sitting next to them enough to find healing and hope and wholeness in the church, because they're not sure what would happen if they opened up their mouth and began to talk. And so Ruth and I will spend the next about 40 minutes engaging this, allowing the scriptures to help us respond to survivors' pain. We'll talk a little bit about purity culture and rape culture and some of the, sadly, similarities between the two. But ultimately looking at the abuse of power, and that is really where sexual abuse finds its place, and then how Christians who are lovers of truth and lovers of justice, how we might need to reposition ourselves to think about this reality in light of Jesus, and to think about this reality in light of the scriptures, and to think about this reality as it pertains to our quote-unquote greatness in the kingdom being ultimately defined by how well we care for those who are hurting. And so we want to be a church that shines light into the darkness, and we want to be able to grow in our willingness and courage to step into these broken and ugly parts of our world and to offer healing and hope and the person of Jesus into those places. So that's enough by way of introduction for me. I'm excited for you to hear Ruth's voice. I'll put a link in the show notes for her book. You'll want to go out and buy it. And so I simply offer to you the conversation I have with Ruth Everhart. So on the show today, I'm really thankful to have Ruth Everhart with us to talk about her book, The Me Too Reckoning, Facing the Church's Complicity in Sexual Abuse and Misconduct. And Ruth, I'm really thankful that you've agreed to come and talk with us for a little bit today.
Thanks, Joshua. I was just very glad for the invitation. Happy to be here.
Wonderful. Ruth and I were just talking a bit before we started to record. And Ruth, I don't know how many of my listeners have read your book. I know, I bet several of them have. But for those who haven't, or for those who have, I wondered if you would just take a few minutes here at the beginning and tell us a little bit about yourself and maybe what led to the writing of this book last year.
Well, sure. I'm a pastor. I'm a Presbyterian pastor, have been for a number of decades, and I'm an author also. But I'm also the victim of sexual violence. More than once, I have been assaulted. And so a few years ago, I had written a memoir about being raped at gunpoint when I was just 20 years old. And the title of that memoir is Ruined, which is kind of a indicator, early indicator of what that experience did to me in my view. I felt like my life and my very being had been ruined by that sexual assault, largely because of my religious upbringing. So what I wanted to do after a few decades of growth and maturity and ministry under my belt was kind of revisit that experience and ask myself why it felt so ruining to have a stranger break into my home and assault me. And to experience that, I mean, it's a horrendous experience, but it was made much worse by what I believed about myself and about sexuality and about femaleness. So I wrote that memoir and it came out in 2016. And I had a lot of response to the memoir. And what it made me realize is that there weren't a lot of people of faith talking about this subject at that time. And shortly after that, the Me Too movement really began to take hold in the fall of 2017. And so I really hoped that the church would be more vocal and that people of faith would use that as kind of a springboard, an opportunity to talk about this subject of sexual assault. And what I found is that we weren't. Church leaders in, you know, in a broadly speaking, we're not really engaging that conversation in a helpful way. And so I decided to enlarge my lens back up from just my own story and look at a whole lot of other stories, because one of the responses to my memoir was to be kind of flooded with stories of other people who'd endured sexual assault of various kinds. And so I wanted to specifically look at sexual assault within faith communities and how that community responded. So that was the genesis of this book, The Me Too Reckoning.
Yeah. Well, Ruth, I really appreciate you taking a few minutes to share that with us. I feel like your experience and this book in particular, I actually haven't read your Ruined memoir. I've only read The Me Too Reckoning, but it's such a needed missing piece in the evangelical church culture. I know I'm a pastor at present, and I've had experiences before of bringing up the Me Too movement in a church and had members with instant, I think you've addressed it toward the end of your book, but just instant, well, those are just false accusations, and almost as if this doesn't even get a hearing, that real lives having been damaged and having been negatively affected, as you keep saying, even in the church, like this is something that needs to be talked about. So your process then, how do you kind of set this up in your book or in your own church ministry to make sure that we aren't dismissing this, make sure that we're letting the real weight of real women's stories be heard by the Christian community?
Well, you're right that it's a great challenge, and many people feel very threatened that this is such a problem, that sexual abuse is so prevalent. And so I think what has to happen is simply opening the conversation and letting the voices of victims carry the day. I know that when I was speaking in the wake of my memoir, for instance, I remember speaking in a large conservative congregation in Vancouver, British Columbia, and it was the same weekend that the Harvey Weinstein story had broken. And I just want to share this story because this wasn't even the pastor who kind of raised the question. This was a very gutsy lay leader, an elder, who was leading the prayers of the people. And before he did that, he simply asked, had you heard about this Me Too movement that was begun? And would the people who are present have the courage to raise their hands and claim that they were a Me Too? And I was sitting up front and I looked out over the congregation and I was just shocked that so many people had the courage to begin creeping their hands up into the air. And then he said, and how many of you here love someone who's a Me Too? And then all these hands went up in the air, and there were so many tears on faces. And that was really the moment when I started knowing I was going to write this book, because wow. I thought, look at this. This is why the church exists, to be a faith community, to have other people join you, whether you're a victim or a survivor, and stand alongside you and say, your pain is our pain. We share this with you, and we are willing to listen. And I went on to preach that day on the woman, Jesus healing the woman with the flow of blood, as we call her, the woman who never quit hemorrhaging, or the woman who had a period that never ended. And so it was just a really powerful moment. And so that combination of giving victims and survivors a voice and then using scripture to respond to their pain, I think has become for me the model of what churches can do and the power that churches can harness.
Yeah. Well, and Ruth, I have never read a book quite as unique as yours, not just for its subject matter, but for the way that you laid the book out. So you used the woman with the flow of blood, as you said, and you made a comment about how it's almost maybe unfair, maybe is the right word, but how it's always the healthy people who get to label the sick people a certain way. But this woman was seen by Jesus for who she was, which is so necessary. But you talk about Tamar, you talk about Bathsheba, and you go back into these, again, biblical stories, which as a man, I tend to read them a certain way. And yet you're talking about how with Tamar, you know, the two sons, one who defends her and one who rapes her, are the ones who the story is focused about. David mourns over his sons, but he never mourns over his daughter. And Ruth, you pulled out so many rich insights right from our Bibles, and yet, generally speaking, those points aren't being made by pastors, at least not ones I've heard of, and I am a pastor, and I'm not teaching them like that. And so you did, I thought, a beautiful job, convicting job, of weaving these narratives right along with your own story and your own battle with authorities in the church and those who dismissed you and didn't want you to have a voice or didn't want others to have a voice. And so I wanted to just thank you for your writing in that way, and ask if you maybe just talk to our listeners just a little bit about what you see when you look at some of those kinds of stories in scripture.
Well, thanks for reading them and engaging with it so deeply. I think that it's challenging for some people to do that. And when I first was writing the book, you know, I did it in a more classic style where I would tell my story and then I would go into the scripture and kind of try to exegete the scripture, break it open for the reader, put it in its historic context and so on. And I sat kind of, you know, part A and part B of every chapter. And it came back from the editor saying, could you weave them together? And I had, like you, I had never actually seen that done, but I found that very challenging and so rich when I started to do it, because I think for me, what my faith has grown so much in the past few years, where I see these stories as not being the Bible happening over there and Ruth's story happening over here, but it's almost like I can imagine Jesus just entering my story, and what would he say? He would speak to me the same way he spoke to the woman who was bleeding, who reached out, who was so brave and reached out and touched the hem of his garment and was healed. And so we became this exercise in kind of traversing millennia and imagining Jesus present. It was really a spiritual experience for me. And I think just deepened my own healing, which had already, you know, this thing about healing. I mean, just to digress for a moment, the church wants to focus on sexual abuse by saying to women who've been abused or to men who've been abused, because it's not just women, although it's largely women, but to say to these people, You know, it's too bad that happened to you, and I really hope that you can go find healing somewhere. And there is the it becomes another burden we place on them. And it's a way of distancing them and of treating them as other and of treating them as less worthy and less valuable and less than. And the Jesus that I meet in scripture doesn't treat anybody that way. Does yeah. not treat anybody as less worthy. So my healing had, you know, I'd been to seminary, I'd been in many faith communities, I had spent a lot of time and energy, life energy. I'm the mother of daughters, so I was very focused on how can I be a healthy mother to them? How can I raise them as healthy females in this culture? Even so, for me to encounter the scripture and weave it in my own story, I found really gave me unique moments and insights that I will be forever grateful for.
Yeah. And you had said, I think, in your book that when you decided to go off to seminary and study, and that was, I don't think these are the words you used, but that was kind of a no-no. You know, women don't go off to seminary and get theologically trained. And I grew up more or less in a similar context where that really wasn't, you know, something that women did. I've since changed my mind about that. But what types of things do you see, teachings or beliefs that maybe the conservative church has or holds to that you've seen kind of set us up to be places where sexual abuse is able to happen in churches?
Well, sexual abuse happens wherever there is an imbalance of power, and the person in power is able to exert their power in a sexual way without the victim having any recourse. And so whenever there's an imbalance of power and people are not trustworthy, you're going to have sexual abuse. And just because it's acted out in a way that involves our sexuality or maybe even our genitalia, you know, there is this attitude that somehow it's a separate subject. But it's not really. It's the same old story that you find throughout scriptures of people abusing their power. And so I think if we just always use that lens, it's very helpful for people in church because we're so kind of squeamish about anything to do with our bodies, which is kind of ironic being that we have a faith and, you know, the one who was incarnated, you know, God made flesh, Jesus Christ. So you would think we would be kind of happy about our bodies and have a positive and healthy relationship with them. But there is this kind of generalized squeamishness about bodies. And that gets in the way of talking about sexual abuse for what it is, which is the abuse of power.
Yeah. Yeah. And that came out really clear. I think you had compared the purity culture movement to rape culture. And, I'm in my early 40s now, so purity culture was the thing that I was surrounded with when I was in my junior high and high school years. So that when I keep hearing that surface, could you just give kind of an overview of how you see that relationship formed between, you know, maybe some generalities about purity culture and then how that actually is leads to a potentially a rape culture kind of idea?
Right. So purity culture, which probably some of your listeners are familiar with, is just this notion that that women are responsible for the sexual behavior of men. I mean, that's what underlies it, even though what it looks like is this emphasis on modesty, is an emphasis on keeping people from experiencing the emotion of lust. Instead of teaching people how to deal with lust, it's saying that it should never arise because we should be careful that boys don't glimpse too much skin or have these impure thoughts. So when we talk about purity culture, it's usually about women covering up, and then kind of policing what boys do and being responsible for that. which, just to remind you, is not how God designed it, that we are all made in the image of God. We all have the ability to make choices about our lives that matter. And so that devolves to each human being, no matter your gender or your sexuality, you know, what choices are you making in the moment? But this emphasis on women, you know, kind of screening themselves from men's eyes, can seem very different from rape culture, which is kind of this term that we use for a culture in which sexual abuse is normative. But what's similar about both of these is that basically women are seen as being rapeable. In other words, it's somehow in a normal progression. It's at one end of the spectrum of normal behavior for boys to prey upon girls or for men to prey upon women and to rape them. So that's kind of why I see them in forming kind of an interesting polarity, because they both, purity culture and rape culture, treat women as having very little agency and as their bodily integrity is not being really all that important. And so in a sense that they are just less than fully human. Somehow that women are so different from men that they are just a little farther from God, or a little farther from full humanity.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really sad and I guess maybe humiliating to realize that teaching like that, maybe it isn't stated as explicitly as that, but the way sometimes the Bible is used and the way conversations happen, you think, oh yeah, this is God's plan. And then you see, as we're seeing today, I mean, it's not, your involvement in this has given you eyes to see it much longer than, let's say, somebody like me, but it's hard to avoid now. We're at a place all across our country where scandals have surfaced, and you said somewhere, especially as it pertains to false accusations, that less than, I think you said less than 0.05 of 1% of, oh goodness, now I'm missing it. Either of rapes are actually, like convictions are given for those, or, people are ever found out that they actually didn't commit the offense.
You're thinking it's page 5 in the introduction, Josh.
Okay, great. Thank you. 1.05% of all rapes ends in conviction. Thank you. Very, very nice to be talking to the author who knows her book well enough to tell me where to go. But I found that was shocking, because when the conclusion is, oh, that must be fake. Oh, that must be false. Oh, that's just an accusation. And you realize the countless thousands and millions of real cases where real suffering has happened to real people, and it never gets, their justice is never served. And so trying to position ourselves as Christians who are lovers of the truth and lovers of justice, and then sensing this imbalance of, how do we reposture ourselves to be people who remain open and truly seek the truth and are maybe aware of those power dynamics that we're tempted to protect and preserve at all costs, and to set those aside while we listen to victims? I mean, honestly, Ruth, I believe everything you're saying, and then I really try to apply it and imagine, how do I lead a group of people into shifting a major mindset that's just subconsciously rooted in most people's minds. It's really hard.
It's so good to hear you say that, though, to hear you struggling with it. And I'd be curious to know what you see as those major roadblocks from where you sit. Yeah.
Yeah, from where I sit, the biggest roadblock, if this is just my assessment, but it is that when words like "Me Too" are used, people almost instinctively hear them in partisan political terms. So they hear them as, oh, this is in my church, maybe this is lots of churches, but my church generally is probably more conservative leaning in terms of political spectrum. And so the quick dismissive comment is, oh, that's just a liberal agenda that doesn't amount to something. And they'll use political cases of times when they suspect somebody was just trying to keep someone out of office. And so they accused them of X, Y, Z. I think what I hear, though, from your book, and I know several sexual abuse survivors myself, is to realize all of the hurt and the baggage and the years of struggle that they carry, that our message of, oh, that's just a liberal agenda, like, that can't offer good news and hope to anyone, because you're not even listening to the critique. So for me, I tend to see a lot of difficulty. I'm trying to strip the kingdom away from people thinking that it is being activated through a partisan agenda on either side of the aisle, so that Jesus has the freedom to speak to real people in the real world. That's, I guess, at least one area that I see that I have to try to address, because when that comes up, oh, that's just the Me Too thing. I'm like, it's not a thing. Like, these are real people who don't have a voice. And if I understand correctly from listening to podcasts and reading books, the rejection that a sexual abuse survivor receives upon not being believed hurts worse than the initial sexual abuse itself. And I don't know if that's a fair, maybe not hurt worse. It hurts every bit as much as the original sexual abuse, because now they're being questioned and their feelings or their memory is called into question, and they're not being valued for the struggle that they've had to endure.
It certainly layers more damage and hurt upon an already painful situation.
Yeah.
Yeah, and especially sure. When it's in a place that you want to believe is associated with grace and mercy and healing and love and all that good stuff. And when, instead of providing that, it provides more pain, I think it's very silencing. You know, you get the sense, well, why did I open my mouth? And I have a whole chapter on how shame interacts with silencing and how that happens. And that's where I use the story of Tamar, because her brother, who was supposedly helping her in her, after she'd been raped by her other brother, he still silenced her, you know, in the name of what is good and holy. And I think the church in the last few millennia hasn't learned how to do it better, and it's just time, which is why I call it a reckoning. And I want to embrace the Me Too movement, at least as for showing, it's all about shining light into the darkness, right? And all of exposing what is evil. I appreciated your words about being lovers of the truth.
Well, and you had a fantastic chapter towards the end. You dove into biblical lament, and you tied it really well together between individual lament, but you were painting it as the people of God entering into real lament. And Ruth, that was very, very gripping. You had written, I marked it, this one I actually marked, and I know the page, but it's on 219, and you said, We need to complete the cycle. You had listed in the middle of the page, you said, we need to follow the psalmist's example in every way. Consciously enter the Lord's presence. Hold nothing back. Use powerful language to tell the Lord what we see. Do not mince words. If friends betray us, curse them aloud. Then find the way back to the throne. Place our trust in God, not in ourselves, our own revenge, or our own storms of emotion. End our complaint with the psalmist's words to God, but I will trust in you. And you said, if necessary, force those words through gritted teeth, like whistling in the dark, we may hear and believe our own voice. And I'll be honest, for most of my life, I have never really connected well with the Psalms. Like, the Psalms are deeply emotional. They're deeply disturbing, if we're honest. It's kind of like a no holds barred wrestling match, and I guess we should embrace that, because God bless Jacob in his wrestling match and then renamed him Israel as he who wrestles with God. So God must seem to invite that maybe more than we realize. But it does sound as if what you said was, well, we hope you can find healing, and we kind of want to throw the impetus onto the survivor to just go trust in the Lord. And that's what you're identifying here in Lament as the last step in the process. Mm-hmm. Like somewhere we've got to enter into the ugliness and the brokenness and all the emotions that this touches. And I feel like for some reason, the church is uncomfortable with that ugly, messy, like situation. It's like we need to quickly resolve it. We need to quickly quote a Bible verse. We need to quickly cover it up. Not cover it up. Well, sometimes actually cover it up, but I mean, move on, move to the good part. So do you have any thoughts about why that is? Why we get so unsettled with the difficult, disturbing parts of life and want to move on to the rose-colored glasses so quickly?
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? Because we follow Jesus, who did not do that at all. He doesn't model that ever in his ministry. And yet the church, it really does come back to this issue about power. If you're used to having power, or if you like power, or if you become addicted to power, you become addicted to all the good things that you get from that, esteem and good feelings and other people praising you. You don't like traffic in the dark shadows, the dark places of life, the ugliness. And so I think what happens is the church has been in a place of power for a long time, centuries. And I think that as the culture is shifting and the church, this is backing up from the situation a little bit, Josh, but as the church is shifting its place in culture and it's losing its grip on power, I think that's part of why we're seeing this reaction of wanting to, you know, kind of cover your ears and go, la, 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 you know, everything's fine. Because if not, then we may have to come to terms with the fact that the church is meant to be a mission post, you know, an outpost on the edge of society, speaking a prophetic word, speaking a hard word, speaking truth to power, doing all those kinds of things that we see over and over in scripture. But it just doesn't sound like fun. I mean, it doesn't sound like a party. Yeah. You know, where is the roast pig and a glass of wine and a good time?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I guess those are the flailing, trying to cling to what we hope we can hold on to and never lose. Whereas I do think Jesus invites us into being willing to lose everything. And if we do, we will find new life in him on the other side of that. At least that's what I think he's teaching us.
Well, the first hymn in the Christian church, you know, recorded in Philippians 2, says that mm-hmm. we worship a God who, though he was in the form of God, did not equate equality with God as something to be grasped, you know, but divested himself, taking on the form of a slave.
Wow.
It's powerful.
Yeah, that's
stuff.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is. And I think it's in situations like this where it really requires of us to do the hard work of pulling that kind of a hymn out of a theological context and making sure that it intersects us in an incarnational context. So I think that's what's so rich. I wish it didn't come at the expense of real lives. But you're able to take these theological truths and show us, hey, these work on the ground. But on the ground is dirty and it's messy and people are hurt and there are tears and there's blood. But truth can intersect that too if we let it, which I think is really powerful. So Ruth, I know we're about out of time. I'd like to just ask you one last question, and if something we haven't already talked about, or if we have, but just where do you see the most need today for the church from what you've written here? If there's like one, maybe two, just these are what you see as the most need for the church today from what you've written.
Well, I think that it's all about addressing the abuse of power. What that can look like is to really come alongside of victims and to not only refuse to silence their stories, but to give them a place to speak their stories, to provide a safe place where victims can speak their truth and be heard with love. And if I'm really wild and crazy, I would even like the church to become a safe place for abusers to admit that they've abused. I mean, to look at, because, you know, abuse is on a spectrum. And there's a lot of people who maybe they've never raped somebody, but they did grope or fondle or misuse their power over someone. And now, maybe decades later, could they have the maturity to look back at their younger self and say, you know, what I did was really wrong. And I now can stand corrected. I mean, what if the church became a place where we actually told God the truth of our lives and told each other? I think that would be, I think that would change so many things. I think it would actually be so healthy for the church, because right now I think outsiders look at the church and they think that the church is a place where we just put plaster of Paris over anything ugly and we try to pretend it's smooth and white, not unlike the whited sepulchres. And I think that, you know, if we were to actually speak the truth, I think that we'd actually find that our this wouldn't be the reason to do it, but we would actually find that our cachet in culture would increase because we would be known as a place of truth. And so one thing is to not silence victims, to give them a platform, and to even possibly ask abusers to speak their stories and to reevaluate their actions, and then to pursue justice, to see that healing and justice are sisters, they are companions, and that pursuing justice can be a way of pursuing healing, and that oftentimes people who have been abused, they need partners. And they need advocates, and the church has a role there. And to do all this through the lens of scripture, to have pastors preach sermons on these difficult texts that are easier to ignore. And if some of them don't seem like fodder for preaching, well, they are wonderful fodder for Bible studies and for people to really grapple with. And I think what I was saying earlier about somebody looking back at their own story, well, maybe they could do that through the lens of looking at David's story and the role of Nathan, you know, which is a story I use in the book. And I mean, there's just so many ways this could be done if people have the will to do it.
Yeah, that's right. And I know you had invited people to, you know, you had left some discussion questions at the end of each of those chapters, which could be a launching point too for healthy discussion. I share your vision. I think that's beautiful. I would love to see the church. We're interested in telling God the truth. I mean, it sounds crazy. How have we gotten to the place where something as basic as that is now becoming our goal? But we haven't really been people who do that openly and honestly. So, well, Ruth, thank you so much for taking this time. Thank you for your hours and months and years of work on this book. And thank you for your transparency, your openness, your pastoral heart, and for your just engaging insights into the scriptures and what you can teach us about what it looks like to faithfully follow Jesus today in the midst of the mess.
I appreciate what you're doing and giving me a voice and lifting up my voice. So thank you, Joshua.
You're very welcome. Well, I'm going to put a link to your book in my podcast show notes, so some who haven't read it can go out and buy it. But how will people find you? Do you have a presence on social media, or do you have ways of directing people to things that you're doing in your life and ministry?
Yes, I have a website, which is really my hub, and I do write to my readers maybe once a month or so. You can sign up to get updates when I get around to giving them. And believe me, I do not flood your mailbox. But and there is a contact me button on my website. I get a lot of stories from people that way. I'm also on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook. I'm basically a failure at all those places, but I do try. And
That's wonderful. What's the name of your website?
It's RuthEverhart.com.
Hey, that's easy enough. Good. Well, I'll put a link to that there as well, and hopefully people can be directed and sign up for it.
And I just wanted to mention that the book is out on Audible. So a lot of people like to listen to it, and I just like to be aware of that. And one last late breaking thing is that next month it comes out in a Korean translation.
Are you serious?
So I'm very excited about that. Yes, I guess that in Korea, this is a very taboo subject. And so they're excited about releasing this book there.
Oh, Ruth, that's so exciting. Oh, my goodness. Wow. Well, I hope that lots of people are changed and just lifted up and encouraged by, you said that comes out next month?
Yes, in August.
Oh, that's so neat. Wow. Yeah, I know it is very taboo. You're right. And so I'm hoping, I'll be praying that this, that your work has a serious life-changing effect there.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, thanks again for taking the time to talk, and I hope you have a fantastic week.
Thank you. You too. Take care, Joshua.
All righty. Bye-bye. Well, I really hope that you were encouraged by today's episode and by that conversation. That's one that we definitely need to have, and I would encourage you to share this episode with somebody that you know who maybe needs to hear it, or to sit around in a small group and play the conversation and then have a conversation of your own about it. There's tremendous opportunity for growth and for Jesus to do exciting, powerful things in and through the lives of his people by his Spirit when we do this in small gatherings. As I shared in the introduction, I will leave a link to Ruth's book in the show notes, as well as a link to her website where she does most of her activity. And then you are able also to find Ruth on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, all of the main places on social media, at least for our generation. So that's all that I have for this week. Thanks again so much for tuning in. And as I said, just share this episode, if only this one, with somebody who you think would be encouraged by it. And as always, have a great week. Talk to you next time.